podcast brought to you by the Triad Network. This podcast is designed to share trending topics occurring within the world and our communities and bring them a behavioral and mental health perspective.
Welcome to Behavioral Health Today, a Triad production. I'm your host, Dr. Graham Taylor. People like professional sports for a number of reasons. Athletes are aesthetically pleasing, and like the theater, it's a venue for emotional expression. It's a great feeling to get behind a team and to share with others in supporting them. In doing so, there are feelings of excitement and unpredictability, identification, a space for emotional expression, and a vicarious sense of overcoming adversity. Sports also provides us with needed escape at times from our troubles, and they can provide us with a sense of belonging and a connection to the wider world. However, while we fans may be enjoying the performances we get to watch, we don't often fully appreciate the degrees of pressure on elite athletes. Their training loads, performance demands, suck-it-up mantras, and the win-at-all-cost mentality present a unique concern for the mental health among athletes. With me today to talk about the psychological demands on professional and elite athletes and strategies to support their mental health is Dr. William Parham. Bill is the inaugural director of the National Basketball Players Association Mental Health and Wellness Program, a position he has held since May 2018. In addition to his involvement with the NBPA, Bill is a professor in the counseling program at Loyola Marymount University, where he focuses his teaching on a variety of courses, including trauma counseling and multicultural counseling. Bill, welcome to our show.
Good afternoon, and thank you for the invitation, and good afternoon, everybody listening.
It's great to have you here. You know, as we start out today, Bill, I know you want to make a distinction between the NBA, the National Basketball Association, and the NBPA, the National Basketball Players Association. Would you please just give us a two-minute drill on this and the distinction for us and why it's important?
Absolutely, a great question. When the audience really listens to NBA, they immediately talk about players and strategies and trade deadlines and so forth, and that's an appropriate conversation. At the baseline, however, the NBA, we're talking about the billionaire owners, persons who own those sport enterprises. The Players Association is a different organization. Mm-hmm. They were launched in 1954, and essentially it was player-driven. And the players essentially were saying, I'm continuing to hoop. I enjoy it. I want to hoop for you in this organization. But we're going to need some additional compensations and considerations for our time and talents. That launched in 1954. Fast forward to 2021. It is a separate organization. It is the voice or the union of the players, led by an executive council of players. There is a great relationship between the two organizations, but they are very, very distinct. So the Players Association is the voice of the players.
Very good.
The NBA is often the voice of the owners.
Very good. I appreciate that. Yes. You know, we're talking about giving voice to mental health here, and I know that as we address mental health and athletics, I know from our conversations that you see it as important to understand mental health not as a dichotomy, not as one is mentally ill or one is mentally healthy. In other words, one is not mentally ill simply in the absence of a mental health illness, but instead you see mental health on a continuum. Explain why this is important to understand it in this way and why it's important in terms of detection and also intervention at the various levels of an athlete's life.
Great question, and you're right. I do really espouse the continuum versus the dichotomous model. The dichotomous model, one, is faulty. It's believable. It's easy to remember, but it's flat out not true.
Yes.
It has a legacy of belief, and so people just sort of go along with it without questioning, because it's easier to put something in a pigeonhole. That's right. But the actual reality is it's on a continuum, and let's imagine a continuum from 1 to 10. Up at the 8, 9, and 10, you find folks who are feeling pretty balanced across domains of their life, sport, work, family, leisure pursuits, fitness regimens, etc. They feel confident in their skills. They feel they have a number of options and a strong belief in their abilities to create options if they don't have any. They seem to have a good perspective, not so full of themselves, and understand that every day, every week, every venture in their life is an opportunity to move forward. Then there's a group from, let's say, 4 to 7, right in the mid-range. Those folks are actually doing pretty well also. They feel pretty balanced. They feel like they have a lot of control, as much as we can have. But we also see that there's one or two areas that's giving more attention than they need to, whether it's finances or personal relationships or child rearing. There's something that they are needing to spend an additional amount of time on. They seem to manage it, but it's still disproportionate in the greater picture. Then we have the 1 to 3. Those folks are really struggling mightily, feeling disengaged, feeling disconnected, sometimes confused, lost, distracted, depressed, really feel like they have no options, really feeling alone and isolated.
Yeah.
And that's where the real interventions come in.
Really good.
Up at the 8 to 9 is more of the mental wellness. And the last point I want to make, even if you are in the upper echelons of that continuum, it's not about having solid mental health and wellness, about how do I keep it? Because life promises that everything's going to change. And so 10 years from now, circumstances and situations could be quite different. So it's how do you develop a plan, a strategy long term to keep yourself and your circle of influence in check?
What I like about that is if we just look at an either or, they either have it, you know, signs and symptoms, or they don't. It unfortunately can oversimplify and miss, like you're saying, some of the lived experiences and dynamics, often nuanced features of an athlete's life. And what you're saying here too is not just understanding on a continuum, but I'm also hearing you weave in, there's a multidimensional assessment here, kind of a holistic view of an athlete's mental health. And even though they might be thriving and and excelling on the court, they could be struggling in other aspects of their life.
That's correct.
You want people to understand being equally as important.
Without question, because again, when you get the dichotomous model, if you are on the negative, I'm depressed or I'm anxious, everything you do gets put in that category.
That's right.
And or if you're feeling okay, then everything gets put in that category. And rarely are those two realities true. Yeah. It's more true what you've just suggested. For the most part, people are doing pretty well, feeling in command as they can be in their life, but are needing to juggle one or two areas. That really is the profile for most of us. But it also gives us hope that, well, we are in command of things. There's some things we have to work on, and that's the very definition of being human.
That's really good. You were a major contributor in the International Journal of Sports and Exercise Psychology in an article you guys wrote, and you did a great job of distinguishing between clinical mental health disorders, subclinical symptoms, the human condition, and the athlete's condition. And this is what you're advocating here. It's on that continuum, not an either or.
That's correct.
And yeah, it was so well done. And it benefits an athlete to have all of those aspects, that multidimensional focus, assessed with and for them, because they think sometimes I'm doing okay, just as long as I'm performing well. But if I can have these other areas assessed with me, I can actually be better on the court or on the field or in the pool.
There's absolutely no question about that, because really what we're talking about is the compilation of who you are as a human.
Yeah.
Your spirit, your mind, body. It's a combination of factors and variables. It's never just one entity. And it's a complete package. And the word that you used earlier, it does take a multidimensional assessment and appreciation for what are the variables, the tributaries, if you will, that really contribute to the larger stream and the flow of somebody's performance.
Yeah, I think we could even tack onto that something you've encouraged as well, that in addition to those aspects of it, understanding an athlete contextually, you say that it is essential to be doing this, including the impact of larger components, the socioeconomic and political environments. You say that seeing these and understanding an athlete through this lens and context, it's everything, you say. Why so?
Absolutely. But let me put it real in the strongest possible language that I can. Race, culture, ethnicity, sexual orientation, disability, faith-based practices, and other markers of personal identity are always present.
Yes.
Which is code for they are never not important. They may not be critical in a given situation, but they are always there and present. Mm-hmm. That being said, if you disregard any aspect of that, whether knowingly or unknowingly, you really are discounting and robbing yourself, one, of seeing the whole picture and running the risk of the athlete believing that you don't quite get him or her fully.
Right.
And that's a dangerous risk, because then they become the statistic, the performer. What can I do to perform?
Yeah.
Not what can I do to discover who I am,
mm-hmm.
the genius and the innate abilities I possess, so that I can get out there and do my best.
Yeah.
And everybody wins when you invest in the whole person identity of an individual.
Bill, mind down for us a wee bit here into the impact in this time in our lives that the socioeconomic and political environments are impacting athletics.
Without getting real long winded, because I get too passionate about this, so it has been important for me to understand the following. Whether we want to admit it or not, we live in a system that has evidence of racism, sexism, ableism, the haves and the have-nots. People want to deny it. They want to color it differently. They want to reframe it differently. But the facts are, when you look at the disparities in healthcare, education, housing, employment, we can go on and on. It's no accident that the system has been designed for there not to be a level playing field. Without going into a lot of history, know that everywhere we look, there's evidence of that. And sometimes it takes a pandemic, just as COVID. You see, prior to pandemics, when we could go to work and go to museums and go to parks and go to the gym, go to restaurants, those options always serve two goals. One, we get nourished, we get emotionally satisfied, we connect with people, there's bonding, there's an outlet. The second thing that it does, it provides an escape
mm-hmm.
for us not to worry about the baggage and the invisible tattoos of trauma and hurt
yep.
that we don't want to talk about. But when the world was put down in a pandemic shutdown, literally, can't go here, can't go there, literally have to reorient your life. You were yep. only left with your thoughts. And that's when all of that comes to pass. The discrepancies in healthcare access to resources, it's just real plain. And so we don't like to talk about those things. But then when you add to this pandemic, we had another opportunity to awaken when you look at the social justice protests. What I consider not just simply another killing of a Black man by a road cop, but the lynching by knee of George Floyd, witnessed globally. People woke up and said, well, wait a minute, are you kidding me? But understand that I, for example, as an African-American, there's not a day that goes by that I don't think about race in America. I don't have the luxury of not thinking about it. Many African-American athletes will tell you the exact same thing. They hoop and they live their life very present in their spirit, because I'm an African-American man. I don't have the same space privilege that my white counterparts do. Those are realities that people don't talk about. In fact, they've made a cosmetic approach to identify sports, the Olympics, as the ultimate neutralizer of all of that. That has never been true, although it's been believable and promoted. And understanding the richness of where people come from and what makes them who they are,
yeah.
you would see an exponential increase in individual talent, team chemistry, competition, fan excitement, purchase of paraphernalia. I mean, everybody wins when you invest in the whole person
yeah.
and their mental health and wellness. There's absolutely no doubt about it.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
Are you preparing for a licensure exam in psychology, social work, marriage and family therapy, counseling, or behavioral analysis? AATBS is here to help. We have been supporting behavioral and mental health students to prepare for their licensure exams for more than 45 years, working with over 1 million students to succeed on test day and move on to the next step in their career. With products ranging from comprehensive courses to quiz banks and delivered live online, self-study online, and in print, AATBS has test prep solutions that meet every student's needs and learning styles. Visit us today at aatbs.com. That's aatbs.com. And use promo code BHT15 to save 15% off your next purchase.
Clearly, that's your point of advocating here. I want to talk about a couple of things that kind of tag on to that. We have as ACCESS the ACE. It's the assessment that measures adverse childhood experiences. Share with us, because you're kind of holding this up right now too. Share with us your understanding of how one's adverse childhood experiences contributes to their mental health and the whole person that you're trying to advocate for here.
Well, the ACE, or the Adverse Childhood Experience, is a major study that came out in the late 90s, 1996 specifically, to 1998. A joint project by the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta and Kaiser Permanente Medical Center. The question on the table at the time is, to what degree do early adverse childhood experiences impact later physical health? That question came about because American College of Physicians has gone on record as saying fully 2/3 of office visits by 40 years and older persons are for stress-related disorders. So there's something going on other than pure organic evolution. Mm-hmm. There's something that we are doing. So the study was an attempt to look at. One of the discoveries after in excess of 17,000 patients, it was a large-scale study, identified 13 adverse childhood experiences, and they drew a link that early adverse childhood experiences leads to, if you think about it as a pyramid, it's called the ACE pyramid, leads to neurocognitive impairment.
Yeah,
you're talking about single-digit ACE kids when they're learning in brain formation. You're talking about the development of high-risk behaviors. Ultimately, if you follow the pyramid, it comes into premature death.
Right.
Another astounding finding at the ACE study is this. If everybody in the listening audience, an adult, were to go right now into their mobile phone directory and randomly select 100 people, random, out of their directory, 65 out of 100 of those people would have had from 1 to 4 adverse childhood experiences, the earliest of which, not uncommonly, would have been experienced before age 10.
Yeah.
Why is that important? Because those traumas early on are confusing. They bring up a spectrum of emotions, and no single-digit age kid on planet Earth can really understand first what's going on.
Exactly.
Let alone the long-term implications of it. Yet, it is indelibly felt and experienced that something's askew, something's not right.
Yeah.
It really, the image I construct here is that of an invisible tattoo. For those of you in the audience who have tattoos, it's painful to get on. And if you wear clothes during the day, nobody knows you have it.
Right.
But in like manner, all of the emotions that come up as a result of childhood trauma are indelibly etched in our spirit.
That's right.
It goes after a book called The Body Keeps the Score. We don't fully understand it, but it's there.
Yes.
And so as we grow older, get 20s, 30s, 40s, and we have current triggers or stressors, you are actually likely to not only get triggered in response to the current stressor, but also the possibility of reawakening some of that old stuff that you never resolve. And so we are all carrying around baggage. I go on record as saying everybody has baggage. So there's really only two questions ever on the proverbial table. How many pieces of luggage do you have, and what's packed inside each bag?
That's right.
The idea is it's there to explore and to learn from, but due to society stigma, we've been socialized culturally, familiarly, by gender, not to talk about our personal stuff, our personal journey. The authenticity of who we really are is denied. And we want to be dutiful citizens, great sons and daughters, so we don't talk about it until we are forced to.
This is really that multidimensional understanding of athletes, yes, but in our pre-talks, you're talking about this, just the human condition, period. This could be somebody Absolutely. Who's a writer, an artist, you know, an engineer, whatever it may be. This is just the human condition. And you're emphasizing here, again, that multidimensional understanding here. It's the socioeconomic piece. It's the childhood experiences that we have, this whole person in their lives to date. As we hold that, take it into real life. What don't people understand about the true pressures and demands placed upon athletes at these levels?
Well, just think about the true pressures of any adult growing up. Adolescence is typical. But even as we grow older and become adults and married and kids, et cetera, there are a lot of those normal, quote unquote, changes and development. Change is something we do most often. We transition is the most used activity in all of our lives. Mm-hmm. We can't not transition. We're so accustomed to it, we don't even think about it. We just sort of do it. But when you become an athlete, an elite athlete, it's important to start focused, be laser focused early on. The whole issue of balance is out the window. It actually is substituted with sacrifice. Mm-hmm. Tremendous amount of sacrifice, personal sacrifices, family, certain events that mark life's transitions. You decide, I want to be an elite athlete in the basketball. I want to be a hooper. I want to be a Hall of Famer. So you end up dribbling to school with your right hand, dribbling home with your left, dreaming about it when you go to sleep, going to the urban courtyards or your backyard and visioning making that last basket in the seventh game of the championship and That's fans right. cheering for you. I mean, that gets in your spirit. You try to get by with school, with everything else you have to. It's like you really want to load it in what it is going to define you, because that's what you have command about. You're excited about, you're passionate about, your authentic self comes out. And that's something you want to scream and shout about. But that's not an easy task. The grind of getting up every day, going through the ritual of physical injury, damage to the body, making sure that you are strength and conditioning, nutritional, restorative health, your rest. Yeah. All of those things are critical. Looking at game film, playbooks, videos. I mean, it's a lifestyle.
That's right.
And there's no way around it. And the added pressure is that it's a finite window of opportunity. The average athlete in the NBA is 5-6 years. There are some who go longer. When you look at football, when you look at baseball, when you look at soccer, across men and women's sport, it's the same thing. And they know this. When you go to the Olympics, just look at, 100 meters. 9 seconds. So a lifetime of preparing.
That's right.
The next Olympics are in France. As we speak now, there are athletes who've been in preparation for that and training every day, mind, body, and spirit, for those 9 seconds. Right now. And they're going to have to sacrifice. And that's something that people don't understand. And then when you don't make it, you get injured along the way. That can be devastating.
It's a really good point, too. You're talking about in order to reach these levels, so much has to be sacrificed and so much gratification has to be postponed. It's just parcel of excellence at that level right. you're describing. And along with the pressures, you know, playing when injured, not recognizing, you know, struggles, you can't, you know, if you show that, you're going to be weak. Just the whole mentality around that. I know that as you talk about looking at the whole person from a lifespan perspective, how do you see the organizations that these athletes are in, whether it's the owners or the leagues or the professional organizations themselves, managing mental health in sports today?
Well, Graham, this is where I'm going to say something that may sound a bit controversial, but I really just want to invite the audience to consider this.
Please.
The images that are promoted now in professional sports, from the Olympics, professional sports, collegiate level, that there's a growing conversation about the importance of mental health and wellness. And behind all of that is an appearance that American systems of professional, collegiate, and Olympic athletes are now acknowledging that we've not done such a good job in attending to the mental health and wellness of our athletes. One could argue that they are advancing the notion that we have failed at addressing the mental health and wellness of our athletes, and now we want to correct that. I personally don't buy that argument. I believe very strongly that the systems of athletics across levels have not failed at addressing the needs, the mental health and wellness needs of athletes. They have succeeded at not addressing
them. Yeah.
They've not wanted to hear about it,
right?
Largely based on stigma, largely based on the belief, unfounded, mind you, that if you start talking about your personal stuff, you're going to open up Pandora's box of compromise.
Yes. Yeah.
And you're going to have a product that's not as lucrative, that's not as professional,
yeah,
that somehow it was stained.
Yeah.
And so they decide to go and not deal with it.
Yeah.
When you put it in a business model, if you have 450, for example, men in a National Basketball League, they call it the 450 fraternity, how many thousands of guys are outside of that fraternity wanting to get in and have the skills to get in? So from a business point of view, an owner is willing to cooperate and go pay handsomely and get his product or her product out there. But at the end of the day, they feel that they have a number of people who can replace them.
Yeah.
And that's true with many sports. And so we have an incentive to really not talk about our stuff, to not want to open up that Pandora's box. And again, in doing so, the GOAT labels that we affix to many of our athletes, in my opinion, we have not yet begun to see what real GOAT behavior looks like.
Yeah.
And were we to invest in from the beginning, and I'm talking about teenage years,
right,
in basketball, they go to camps, Nike camps, and AAU, and Top 100, and they're groomed in these systems. Same way with soccer, same way with gymnastics. All of those systems early on should have a mental health and wellness component as part of their regimen. There's just
no question. Folks, pardon the interruption, but we will continue this discussion on our next show. I want to thank our guest, Dr. Bill Parham, for coming on the show today. For more information about the National Basketball Players Association Mental Health and Wellness Department, please visit nbpa.com/mental wellness. For more information about athletes and mental health, Bill has provided us with a number of resources which can be found in the description of our show, and I would encourage anyone listening to learn more about these in the links provided there. And lastly, I want to thank our listeners for joining us today, and we hope you'll be joining us next time on Behavior Health Today.
We appreciate all the support from our community, and if you like our show, one of the best ways you can support it is by giving us a 5-star rating and leaving a review. Behavioral Health Today is a podcast part of the Tribe Network, all rights reserved.